Interview number 119, Larry Brown, One Story of Storytelling in Higher Education.
Thank you, my dear brother. What a beautiful soul.
All children love stories.
Folk tales, they are messages from our ancestors.
Then you have come to the right place.
We will have a storyteller in every school.
Storytelling can teach.
You have that openness of a child.
Good on you, Eric, for doing what you're doing.
That's a great question.
Thank you. I'm inspired just to be here. I'm really honored to be here.
We tell stories.
Know yourself.
Follow your passion.
And live with grace.
Hey, welcome to The Art of Storytelling, and this is Brother Wolf, and I am so thrilled that you have taken a few moments, that you have taken a little bit of your time, a little bit of your energy to come here and to listen to us, because I have found a guest who has used storytelling for a long time in some very interesting, very, should I say, traditional places. And what's interesting to me about that is that the application of storytelling in the dry and the dusty, for example, the university or college systems, or perhaps even the clergy, is fascinating to me. Because I am on a mission to find every single possible use of the word storytelling. And my guest, of course, is Larry Brown. Thanks for coming on the show, Larry.
Well, thank you for having me.
So first, a little bit more about Larry Brown. But first, let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Larry Brown is an assistant professor of human geography at the University of Missouri, located in Columbia, Missouri. He has been storytelling for nearly 30 years. He's the co-founder and current co-president of the Mid-Missouri Organization for Storytelling, MOST, centered in Columbia, Missouri. Past president of the Storytelling in Higher Education, SIG, of the National Storytelling Network, NSN, a member of the NSN board, a member of the River and Prairie Story Weavers, and a member of the National Organization of Biblical Storytellers. He tells to all ages and is known for his original Jack Tales and ghost stories, as well as personal Christmas and medieval stories. Larry Brown received a PhD from the College of Education, Department of Education and Policy Analysis at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Majoring in policy studies, he conducted research into the racial, racist, religious rights movement called Christian Identity. He is also a graduate of the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, in sociology, received a Master's of Divinity from Christian Theology Seminary, Indianapolis, and a Master's of Arts in Geography from the University of Missouri, Columbia. In addition to teaching at MU, he taught at Stephens College and the Missouri School of Religion. He has pastored congregations for 30 years in Nebraska, Indiana, and Missouri before becoming a full-time professor. He has published several articles on such topics as the Christian Identity Movement, Domestic Terrorism, Islam and Christianity, Youth Ministry, Stewardship, and Christian Worship. Larry is the author of the Missouri School of Religion resource booklet entitled Worship in the Small Congregations. Larry's story, The Angel of River Road, appeared in the 2009 August House Book of Scary Stories. So, Larry, do you have a story you could share?
Yes, let me tell you one that really comes out of my childhood. A little town where I grew up in southwestern Nebraska, about 1,000 people. Not a lot of events during the course of a year that would create a lot of drama and imagination. But for me as a child, it was the weeks leading up to Christmas. A number of traditions that little community did. As I recall, it was always the Saturday following Thanksgiving that began the Christmas season. It had a number of events. The downtown businesses, now this is a two-block string of businesses, you understand, all of the downtown businesses would prepare their windows for advertising and selling their wares during the Christmas season, but they would unveil their windows on that Saturday after Thanksgiving. And that evening, the high school band would come downtown, play a little concert. After the concert, the lights would come on, the stores would display their windows, and the utility folks there in the city would turn on the decorations that they had on all of the poles. And in my memory, of course, as a child, every year the snow would be gently falling, And it was, you know, idyllic. But it was the anticipation. The businesses would have little contests that they put in their window. Guess the number of beans in a jar. And the winner would be given their prizes on Saturday afternoons at the little theater there in the Saturday afternoon matinee. One year I won a silver dollar for guessing the number of beans in a jar. But it was the Saturday before Christmas that was really the highlight, not only for me, but of course for every kid in the town, because that's when Santa arrived. We all gathered down at the end of Main Street near the city auditorium, and we would know that Santa was coming because we would hear the fire truck come from the other end of I don't know how it is in your little town, but Santa arrived on the fire truck, and strangely, of course, all of the elves looked like the volunteer fire department. But we kids would be gathering there, and the fire truck would come off. Santa would step down off the back of the fire truck and wade into this little crowd of children. And he would present to each one of us a little mesh stocking filled with hard candy and a few plastic toys and so on. But what was most important, Santa would lean down toward us. And for me, he would lean over and hand me that mesh stocking full of candy and say, "Merry Christmas, Larry." Santa knew my name. So every year that was just so wonderful. But the year came that I don't know whether it was the city fathers and mothers made that decision based on the economics or rumors that kids from Kansas had been coming up and getting free goodies, but they decided not to have Santa come. That means we wouldn't be waiting in anticipation. I wouldn't get that little mesh stocking full of stuff that I had already experienced now, the last Santa. That was devastating to me as a kid. But fortunately, the minister of our little church that we had then perhaps knew the kind of trauma that was causing to kids, because that year he proposed that we were going to have something new and special at our church for the Christmas program. Now, always we had a kind of a little Christmas evening. It was usually a Sunday night before Christmas. There would be gathering and singing of Christmas songs and lighting of candles, and sometimes it would be a little reenactment of the Christmas story, you know, the bathrobes and all that kind of production. Well, this year, Reverend Votaw, Ellis Votaw, announced that we were going to have a living Christmas tree. And he convinced the elders of the church to build in the corner of the sanctuary all of these tiered board structure that would sort of look like a pyramid in the corner. And all of us kids would wear little green capes and hold little battery-operated candles. And we assume our position on these rafters, and the lights would dim, and we would turn on our little battery-operated candles and sing, and we would be the living Christmas tree. Oh, this was alleviating a lot of my disappointment and fears that I'd experienced the last Santa, because now there was something to look forward to. Now, I don't know how he convinced all of the parents that this could be done. I don't know the magic of that, but I respected Reverend Votaw, and he was a tall man. He was a World War II veteran, and he wore an apparatus to hold his leg together, some kind of a brace, and he was always an imposing figure. And so even as I, as a little kid, looked up to do whatever he said, I suspected maybe the parents did too. Well, if Reverend Votaw says we can do it, we would do it. And sure enough, then as the weeks of practice and preparation were coming, it was going to be wonderful. Now, always a part of that Christmas church program was, at the end of that event, we would all file out of the sanctuary, and there was a little old couple that would always prepare little sacks of candy, a little brown, like a sandwich sack, and they would be peanuts and hard candy and some chocolate drops and an orange. And as I remember, at the end of that, I would always be so grateful to get that, and I would receive it. It was one of those sacks of candy that the orange was dropped in last, so if you opened up your sack and pulled out your orange, everything kind of came with it, because the hard candy had stuck to the peanuts and so on, and so you'd put it down on the table and break it apart. And that little couple had done that apparently for years and years and years, so that had become a tradition, and so I was looking forward to that the whole time. Well, in the week before this Christmas production at the church, I remember that my mother had called us kids into the living room, and she said, "I have some sad news. Minnie Polance died." Now, George and Minnie Polance were the couple that always prepared the candy. And when I knew that she was old and she was frail and she was sick, but she died the week before Christmas. And I began to figure out as a kid, oh no, not only have we lost Santa, but now I'm not going to get the sack of candy from George and Minnie Polance after the Christmas play. Well, that Sunday evening it happened. And the program went off without a hitch. Not a single kid was injured or killed falling off the living Christmas tree. At the end, the lights dimmed and our little electric candles lit up, and we sang Silent Night, and everybody was tearful, and it was wonderful. But then we had to walk out of the sanctuary, dreading now, on my part, that horrible moment when we just have to go home with no sack of candy. But to my surprise, as we came out of the sanctuary, there was George Polance still handing out sacks of candy. I was amazed. I went up to him, and he leaned over and gave me my sack of candy and said, "Merry Christmas, Larry." I knew that voice, and I knew that I had not experienced the last Santa.
That is such a sweet, that is such a, what's the, you know, the movie, A Wonderful Life moment. You know, not A Wonderful Life, the movie about Christmas, everybody knows.
Well, okay. they're melodramatic.
Yes, that's Shoot Your Eye Out movie.
Oh, Put Your Eye Out.
Yeah, what's it called? What's the movie called? Who knows? Okay, let's do that over again. That's a great story. I love that story. In crafting that story, how much is poetic license and how much is based on complete reality?
All of the episodes in that story actually occurred. The names were not changed. The literal sequence of all of those things happening at exactly the same time, I messed with a little bit, but not much. Just enough to try to build up some of the dramatic effect, so that I feel that story and I see that story as I tell it. So it was shaped to have a narrative flow, but it comes out of real life experiences.
Let's talk about your use of storytelling in the classroom.
Well, I teach college level, and I teach human geography. So I have Introduction to Human Geography, some regional courses. I teach the geography of the world's religions. I do a seminar on white nationalism. I do basic geography courses to undergraduate for the most part. And so I'm introducing the world in many ways to these students who haven't thought much at that scale. And how I have been experiencing college students that don't necessarily pay attention to world news, to current events. There are also students that often experience geography as like trying to memorize an encyclopedia, you know, just overwhelmed with facts and figures and, or as we say, factoids, you know, little bits of information. And what I have found is that when I'm talking about a particular geographic concept, or whether we're dealing with a place, or whether we're dealing with an issue, if I can put it in, again, a narrative form, or connect to my personal experience. I mean, I've traveled some places, but I can oftentimes package the concepts and the information in a narrative style, and I find, again, students are more likely to connect, to remember, increases the comprehension a bit if I can do it that way. Now, I know that by, again, what I see in the test scores, particularly in the written scores. I know that also at the end of the year when students write their evaluations. In my Geography of the World's Religion class, I intentionally set aside several class sessions in which I put away the technology, basically just talk, do use the blackboard, but fill it with lots of stories. And I will ask at the end of the year, the PowerPoint presentations or the videos that I brought in or the blackboard lectures that I did, tell me about the effectiveness. And I will continually get folks to say, oh yeah, those times that you just talked and did the blackboard, I remembered more. I had time to think about it. The images were clearer. Well, the images only came from the oral narrative. They were seeing lots of images throughout the last of the semester with PowerPoints, because I use lots of photos and maps and so on. But for them to say the images were clear tells me then, their minds generated, their imagination generated the images. So that's one thing that happens. It is also when I'm, let's say, in my Introduction to World Regional Geography, a big course that I do in the fall with 425 students. That's a very difficult environment to teach. I'd much rather be in a group of 30 to 50 students where I can walk and talk and engage them. But here I'm basically down at the front of a big auditorium with a huge screen, and I can project all kinds of images. So I have to figure out every class, you know, what is a key story, a key narrative, even though it may only be a few minutes long, that is going to hook them, keep their attention, and get those concepts embedded. I remember once I was doing a lecture on the Midwest. Well, that's my home, so there I could put lots of illustrations and stories and told about two farmers that had very different styles, one that was leaning toward corporate agriculture and one that was leaning toward, that's the way we've always done it, traditional, low impact, more sustainable. So when I put it in the context of personal narratives, then they remember the issues that we have with the changing structure of food in the United States. Or if I'm dealing with Latin America, I do teach the geography of Middle America, that's Mexico, Caribbean, and Central America, and I've traveled there quite a bit. Now, when I can tell the story of being in a little village in Nicaragua, or buying cigars in Cuba, or telling about my experiences in border towns in Mexico, if I can add that personal narrative, then in some ways the students say, oh, that's real. I can trust that. You know, he knows that. He's been there. Or they'll wake up. Now, it's the structuring, too. I can't just say, well, I saw this when I was in Nicaragua, or I was on the slopes of the volcano in Costa Rica, and we saw it. Well, I have to tell the story about the experience and then make sure that tucked into that are those kind of key concepts of human-environmental interaction or the key concepts of transnational corporate interests or the political conflicts. So to get those things inserted in personal narrative becomes the challenge for me in each class session.
It sounds like something that would really lend itself easily to co-teaching with a history teacher.
Well, I've had the opportunity to do some co-teaching. Two summers ago, I did a course on interpreting the cultural landscape as a field-based course with a younger professor. He probably had more current theoretical material in his background. I had more sort of on the ground. I've lived in that area for 30 years experience. So when the two of us put it together, here was the kind of walking and talking in the field that really worked well. I've had a couple of other opportunities to do some at least team work in smaller settings, not a whole semester. But I found that has worked well, and often it's been the case for me to be the one who does the narrative. This past summer, a group of us were involved in a training program for K-12 public school teachers on appreciating the diversity of world religions right there in mid-Missouri. And my job was on the second day of the workshop to put together a field trip. So create narratives on the field trip and then set up interviews and so on, but to be the interpreter, to set the stage, enable the conversation. And again, narrative became very important in that. So I've had those kind of roles of dealing with history, politics, economic, cultural, but it's up to me to weave the story so that folks, again, appreciate, get the conceptual foundation, and make decisions about their own, in this case, about how they will do that in their classrooms.
So one of the things I'm hearing you say is that you bring the story, the place, into a personal narrative.
That's been the most effective tool for me. Now, I have used traditional stories from the regions or contemporary stories about people, places, and events. So it's not all personal narrative. So I do use other resources as well. But it is narrative development, yes.
Aloha, this is Kathy Collins.
And this is Tira. You're listening to Brother Wolf on the Art of Storytelling. Don't forget that. That's one true story. Honest promise.
So if you haven't been to a place, if you're dependent on this personal, how do you then use it for places you haven't been to? How do you use narrative then?
Well, then that's where I find others' narratives. So if it's published material, or I can dip into, again, some of the traditions of storytelling itself and find a story that comes from that area. For example, here was a case of looking at developments, the changing economies of maritime Canada, looking at Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland and so on. The first time I was teaching that, I had no experience. I had not been there. Now, since, I've been to Nova Scotia. But I found some traditional narratives there and stories that I wove in to talk about what fishing meant and then the decline of fishing now today for pollution, environmental issues.
I went to graduate school. We spent I was on the bus in Leslie University. We traveled on a school bus around the country. And 1/4 of one of the 3 semesters traveling, we spent in Nova Scotia learning all about the fisheries and all this stuff. So I think this is, listening is interesting. But
yes.
So go on. I'm sorry.
Well, no. Well, so there I found some traditional stories so I could talk about life based on fishing. Then after I went to Nova Scotia, then I realized, of course, as you travel around Nova Scotia, you're in French culture, you're in Irish culture. There's actually a German culture in one city in Nova Scotia. Then you go into the Scottish culture if you're up in Cape Breton. And you can actually go around and experience most of Europe. And then tucked into that, of course, are the British versus the French political and economic upheavals a couple of centuries ago. Then the indigenous folks that were there previously. And you can see all of those layers on the landscape, but now I can talk about that and I can dip into the traditional cultures and use a narrative piece to talk about those particular places.
Okay, this is a total side note from our actual topic, but I find this subject fascinating, the idea that place, name, and culture are so closely tied in together. And I had a friend when in this program on the bus, we were in Southern California. I was realizing it was actually Newfoundland we went to, not Nova Scotia. But we were in Southern California, and he took the maps out, just the road maps. And then he took different pens, and he would just mark different colors each of the different immigrant populations that came in. I mean, Southern California, you have the natives, then you have the Russians, then you have the Spanish, then you have the British. then you have the Americans, and then you have each immigrant wave since then within the American community. And he was just marking. It was amazing to me to see and to look at the networks that were created by each of these different communities as they came in. And the stories that must be there, you know?
Oh, well, I teach the geography of Missouri. That's one of my regular classes that I teach every year. And the part that is probably the most interesting and fascinating to me is those waves of settlement. So for Missouri, I will spend a class or two on the indigenous cultures that were there, and I can tell about them, but I often try to use narrative form to do it. And then when the French came, and then when the waves of Germans came, and I spent a little time talking about the difference between German Catholic and German Lutheran, where they went, how they developed. And here's a little story that I use to talk about the subsequent settlement of, first of all, indigenous, then Scots-Irish, and then German. And it's the three little pigs. The indigenous folk built their house of straw, and then the Scots-Irish who built their house of sticks, log cabins, and then the Germans who built their houses of brick. Now, I'm a bit facetious when I tell that story, but I find students will remember now sequent occupants by housing structures imposed by different cultures and their different relationships. And so if I say three little pigs, they'll go, oh yeah, indigenous, Scots-Irish, German settlement, sequent occupants. Or particularly when I get into compare-contrast German with Scots-Irish settlement, they'll remember house of sticks, house of bricks. And that's there. And then we talk about the other aspects of culture, but it's built upon that little metaphorical narrative insertion that allows that concept to open up. So when I ask on an exam then, compare contrast Scots-Irish versus German settlement, where, how, what's the differences, and so on, they can do it. And I get these wonderful narratives back interpreting those two cultures.
How many people in the United States do you think use narrative in teaching geography?
Well, I've heard at some academic conferences, and of course I do read some geographies that are very narrative. I used to teach the geography of U.S. and Canada, and one of the texts I used was very narrative. It was a kind of a travelogue. But then again, you will find others that are drier. Well, they may be great in the use of photos, which tell stories, or maps, which tell stories, but the way that the text is written, it's not narrative style. It's often question-answer, and it's more quantitative than qualitative. But in geography, particularly human geography, you'll find more and more of that, there are narratives, particularly those that are regional geographers, because you have to describe what a place is like. Now, yes, you can use video clips and you can use all kinds of photographic representation, but it's like when you put a photograph of a place up, there's a story there. Well, I'll give you an example. Here's New Zealand. Now, because I was in New Zealand, I can tell a personal narrative, but I embellish it with other facts. I was in New Zealand and I saw this on the map, a place called Paradise. And my wife and I decided we wanted to go to Paradise. And we took the road and it was paved, and then it was eventually rock, and then it was a path. And by the time we got to where on the map the town of Paradise was supposed to be, I mean, we're looking at gorgeous snow-covered mountains with a crystal blue lake in the background, and we got to where it should have been, and there was a gate, and it was locked. So we were at the gates of Paradise. And well, now, coming back from that trip, now this was a bit embellished, here we were landing at LAX, and we were reduced to going to the gates of L Terminal. So I went from the gates of paradise to the gates of hell. And, you know, and students are, they get the pun, some of them do, and they laugh and so on. But again, you find the geographers that can package the material. Now, in it, they're going to learn environmental, they'll learn the culture, they'll learn politics and economics, but if it's sometimes those narrative pieces are the hook. And good geographers know how to hook. The geographers that I studied under, who could tell the stories of the road, or the historical geographer that could tell the insight into the German Catholic community, or the geographer that really could talk about the political upheaval in a particular place in narrative form, those are the ones I learned from, remembered, and appreciated most.
So for those of us who don't work in the field of geography, which is probably everyone listening to this, or most of the people listening to this, I break down for us the different methodologies or traditions within the field of geography for teaching, just to give us a framework for understanding how different your style is.
Well, if one is a physical geographer, that is spending most of the time on the so-called natural environment, when you're looking at the processes of land shaping and climate and ocean water systems, the hydrosphere, it's going to be probably more quantitative, more hard science oriented. Although you will note in the field of environmental studies and ecological studies, there's a lot more narrative coming back in, but you would tend to find geographers that are a bit more quantitative. Now, as in geography, we talk about human environmental interaction. And with subjects like climate change today, now we're getting folks who are saying, oh, we got to talk about culture to understand the devastating effects on the environment, or culture's adaptability. And so there'll be more narrative development there, more qualitative approaches. In human geography, when you're talking about, again, urban systems or agriculture, religion, language, demography, that would lend itself more to qualitative and narrative development. But again, you can look at mathematical models in terms of urban structure or transportation structure, and it would get away from the qualitative narrative style approaches there when you start measuring. But the kind of geography that gets at the meaning that people give to places and the changes on the built landscape, the human landscape, the cultural landscape, you're talking about cultural values. And the best way really to communicate that is, again, the stories. What are the stories that cultures are telling to themselves that gives them permission to do what they do? If you look at, say, a landscape that has been modified for agricultural purposes for 8,000 years, irrigation systems or rice paddy development, those folks have to tell the story generation after generation after generation of how you do it. And they've done it primarily through oral tradition. Now, perhaps today, folks get out scientific measurement instruments, and you can use satellite technology to get glimpses of the Earth's shape and its processes and so on, and make those decisions. But through most of human history, it was not made through that kind of scientific quantifiable evaluation, but passing on the stories. This is how we do it. This is how we survive. So that lends itself. Now, there is an aspect of geography that has to do with the technological, the computer cartography, the remote sensing, GPS. Everybody's using GPS. The folks who build that tend to be more quantifiable. But I work with a man who's been working on the Lewis and Clark atlases across the western part of the United States. And he keeps saying, you got to tell the story. You got to read their story, and then you have to put the understanding of that place in a story form for folks to do it. They can't just look at a map or do a virtual image of their trip. You have to build the narrative so it, you understand the sense it made to them then, and the sense we make of that corridor today through story.
Now, for the storytellers who are listening, which is probably many more people, let us describe why geography. I mean, it's nice that you're applying storytelling geography, but many people listening will go, wow, I'm impressed, but why?
Why apply storytelling geography? Or
why geography?
Well, geography is the mother of all. As we say, it's integrative, it's multidisciplinary. Inside geography is political science, anthropology, sociology, history. Biology is even there. So I got into geography because it is so integrative and comprehensive, but also because in a previous life, when I was taking undergraduate studies, I was doing religious studies, sociology, and political science. Later in life, when I went back to school, I found geography was for me the most stimulating because it put things together. It's a more global, comprehensive way of making sense of the world. It was a leap for me based on a decision. I needed some more education. I needed more stimulation. And a friend of mine said, you know, you could go back to school and just study something for fun. I thought, what a concept. Get a degree for fun. And I stumbled into geography. But the appeal was it put so much together. And I think making sense of globalization today is so important. And geography has that way of blending history and the natural environment and political decision making. And for me, I found it as not only a personal reward, but a way of helping others deal with the increasing complexity of the world that's in our face all the time. I think for me, it was personally rewarding to integrate so many disciplines, but for helping other people appreciate the increasing complexity of the globalized systems. How do you make sense individually out of all these things that may seem to be out of control? So geography was a way of getting a handle on our multitude of connections.
So you also applied storytelling inside the clergy.
Yes, that was my first profession. In fact, it was a decision that even goes all the way back to high school. But I went to graduate seminary. And at that time in the early 70s, the dominant sermon development, homiletics, that was present was what we might say now manuscript preaching, that you had a proposition and you supported it with 3 points, the 3-point sermon, as they would say. But it was really the delivering of a written document, and it was based on, in some ways, a scientific method. Again, prove a proposition. But that's not what appealed to me. I found in telling personal stories or telling the stories of biblical material worked better for me. I learned that by taking an extra course that was taught on an inter-semester event. It was called Preaching in the Parables. And it was an awakening for me. It was an affirming that, oh, the most effective teaching that perhaps in the context of religious education that's been done has been done through stories. And so why not? Now, movies do it. Novels do it. Television does it. You package even a 15-second commercial. You turn it into a narrative. So why isn't that being done from the pulpit? It's an ancient tool that still works. So I sort of resisted. Well, today you take homiletics in a theological seminary, graduate seminary, and they're going to be teaching narrative development now. But I remember that kind of tension between old style, new style. Later, when I got into storytelling, I look back and say, oh, that's what I was doing. I was doing storytelling. Now, for me, the immediate recognition, you know, I preach a sermon and someone will have to tell their story that connected to the story that I used as an illustration. Well, later, I started looking at the whole 15 to 20 minute sermon time as one narrative, not a story to make an illustration, but how can you shape that whole 15 or 20 minutes into a narrative? And there were scholars, homiletic professors that were working with that, and now, again, that's very common.
Have you had to defend your style of teaching or preaching, as it were, with other people who are more fixated on the sort of factual recantation?
Oh, I wouldn't say that I've ever had to defend it. In fact, I think it's been the other way around. I do quite a bit of presentation work, workshops in geography-related issues. Someone will call me up and say, would you come and speak to our group about Afghanistan? Or would you speak to us about environmental issues in Missouri? Or would you do that? Well, I'm not an expert in every place in the world and in every field, but I think it's been that appeal of the way that I present material that folks have done that. So I don't worry so much about academic defense. I'm a teacher, not a researcher, and I'm certainly not one that has to rely upon, oh, I published so many academic papers now, but teaching is my arena. And so no one asked me to defend my teaching style, because the evidence of effectiveness is there in what ways we have to measure teaching effectiveness.
So what's interesting about what you just said to me is that an assumption I sort of have coming into this conversation is that in higher education, much of it is so dry because the teachers believe that that's the way they're meant to teach it. And in particular, that they won't accept other people teaching other ways. And I think one of the things I'm learning from this conversation right now is that dryness is really a result of how they were taught, and has more to do with their own unwillingness to look at how other teachers may be more successful or doing things differently. It may have more to do with the fact that many times in higher education, your ability to teach is not necessarily connected with the fact you get a paycheck, you know?
Well, ideally, in higher education, you have to have a service component. You have to have a publishing component, you have to have a teaching component, and ideally you're supposed to balance those things. What happens though now is the publishing / bringing in money has become elevated, and with the economic crises, economic tyranny of the times, you got to be bringing in grants, and so therefore you have to publish, you have to do research and publish stuff that people will pay for. And so teaching, I think, has been de-emphasized. But you made a good point, too, is that I think most professors teach the way they were taught. And even today, well, let's say PowerPoints. They've become so popular. You're going to see a PowerPoint presentation with the bullet points and so on and so on. And now I find students will see a PowerPoint, and the first thing they do is write down or type into their computer the words that appear on the screen. Well, we've got to transfer that to our notes. And it doesn't, of course, go through their brain. It doesn't get integrated. And you see now, when I have students do, let's say, collaborative work or do presentations to the classroom, I have to now tell them, don't do a PowerPoint with bullet points. Find another way. Create a little drama. Tell a story. Get us engaged. Have a game. You know, I don't care. You can do a small little musical drama with costumes, but do some way of communicating what you learned in your collaborative work other than, because the PowerPoint itself now has become dry, boring, and there's not engagement. Now, you can do a PowerPoint if it's coupled with a narrative that allows them to get their imagination, their connections, and so on. And, of course, in the whole semester, it's not just lectures. You know, there's discussion, there's small group, there's activity. As you know, the sequence of learning, if you only hear it, you don't keep much. You've got to engage it. You've got to be personally connected to it. But narrative, I think, becomes the bridge. But now, if you were a professor that only heard dry, boring lectures, or today you only saw PowerPoints with tremendous volumes of words on those PowerPoints, texts, I think, are being less read now, and there's more forms of communicating. But still, if it's just, here's the information, remember it for the exam, or give it back to me in the exam, You can use the slickest, most exciting, you know, formulations and fancy YouTube video splices that are put into the class, but if it's still back to, here's the information, take it, give it back to me. So I find, again, narrative is a way that sort of cuts through and goes around and can utilize even modern technology. But I don't know how many professors out there are modeling that, because that's not what they experienced, was these creative and narrative styles of teaching.
It's definitely true that the narrative must set the pace and the direction, and the medium should follow that story. And many times people let the medium, whether it's the PowerPoint, the slideshow, the talk, the lecture, they let the medium dictate the story, or at least how the story works. And geography is something that is so set in stone. Sorry.
Physical geography.
The physical geography is so set in stone, and human geography is so set in concrete. I can't help it. I gotta stop. Okay. So it's just that leads one to think naturally, making an assumption, which I see you have skipped entirely, that therefore the story that is told in that experience is not very interesting. And I think when you know, the title of this interview clearly is going to be, you know, geography through storytelling. And to me, even putting the word geography in the title of anything is very dangerous. Because I feel like so many people associate geography teaching through multiple choice tests drilled into your head over, you know, what is the capital of da-da, name the country, you know.
Well, and that's partly true, because you have to have a foundation of knowing where things are. And that's in big introductory world regional courses. Yes, we have to revert to a good deal of the multiple choice just to remember this stuff. Now, once you get out of that fundamental basic level, then you get more opportunity.
This is really interesting here. I spent my teenage years playing World War II on a division level scale. So the game was called World in Flames. It took 72 hours of continuous play to finish. So we played it for 10 hours a day for as far as we could get before the board got tipped over or something happened. But my geography of Europe, it's a lot of date, but it's very accurate. Like, I know, you know, you start talking about this country, that country, I know that. You start talking about areas, I mean, sort of Asia, again, that was part of the theater of war. But you start discussing Central Africa.
Right.
And
or the intricacies of the ethnic groups in Latin America.
Right. You know, it's like, this has nothing to do with the, you know, 5 years I spent immersed in the geography of World War II. And something about that experience of that story, which I was reliving every couple months, the complete story and rewriting, you know, playing a key role in as a character, and also the play, approaching it with play and joy and fun. And there's something said for how storytelling allows us to relax into a body of work.
Now, I have the opportunity, I teach the geography of the world's religions, and here I have the opportunity to go to different parts of the world to talk about origins of particular religions. What was the cultural context in which those religions were born? How do they diffuse across the world over time? How do they change with interactions with new cultures? But the point of religion is creating frames of meaning for people. But you can't do that without knowing the physical, historical, cultural contexts. When the United States is engaged in geopolitical conflict in Central Asia, if you don't understand the rootedness of basic frames of meaning in the physical landscape, the history of cultures, the history of politics in those places, you're in deep trouble. You don't understand that Afghanistan is made up of dozens of subcultures who see themselves rooted in those places despite waves of empires that are come through that place. If you don't understand that cultural and environmental complexity, then you're going to be in deep trouble. But to help folks understand that complexity, then you have to have narratives of their self-understanding. I can do that in world religions, perhaps a bit easier, but when I teach political geography, I have got to do that as well to help folks know that. Or take Latin America, for example. If you don't understand the layering of European Roman Catholicism on top of indigenous cultures, and understand how their self-story is a product of that, or the small upper class, wealthy upper class, and a huge poverty class, if you don't understand the story that they've been telling themselves about the colonialism, then you don't understand Latin America. And so here's again why narrative is important for understanding place, and that's why geography is a storytelling discipline when you're getting at those complexities and meanings and contemporary decisions made. Now, political science should be doing that too. Well, and it does to some degree. Anthropology is doing it. Sociology is doing it. So most of the social sciences do that, but maybe not quite as self-consciously, perhaps.
So you've never been accused of watering down geography, of bringing geography into anthropology or into history or into political theory by doing this narrative style of teaching that you're stepping away from quote-unquote traditional, you know, cut-and-paste geography of place?
No. Well, the students wouldn't say that. In fact, if I get negative criticism, it's, there's too much to remember. So, no, I don't think so. No, it's style. It's not sacrifice of content. And it's certainly not sacrifice of critical thinking. I mean, maybe there's some students that are saying, well, and I'll get this, Professor Brown was the hardest professor I had, but he was also the most enjoyable. You know, because I do use humor as well. Now, sometimes folks will get upset that I have used, say, political humor, and that may not have matched their political perspectives. But it's the emphasis for me is still on critical thinking. But you can't be a critical thinker until you know the stuff, and you can't know the stuff until you've understood their stories. If that makes sense. I don't mean to imply that learning is linear, and I think learning is not linear. I think it's you have to understand history, you have to understand hopes for the future, you have to understand the web or network connections of relationships between culture and the natural systems, and there's nothing really linear about that. Yes, there are causes and effects, so that's critical thinking at a level to make those connections. So that's academically demanding to say, oh, don't forget that. Some disciplines will narrow it down, I think. Geography stops you from narrowing it down. There's always, oh, take this into account. Oh, don't forget this. Oh, remember this. So we're creating a network of networks, in a sense, to figure out places.
This is Sherry Northolk, and you are listening to The Art of Storytelling with Brother Wolf.
Do you have an offer you could share with the audience?
I'm the past president of Storytelling in Higher Education, Special Interest Group of NSN, and we are now launching a multi-year plan of looking at global storytelling from a higher education standpoint. We would like to have more people take seriously the opportunities to be involved in global storytelling exchanges, utilization of global storytelling in the classroom. We would like to have connections among performance-oriented storytelling, folklore kinds of research, and contemporary communication across the planet. And also we're trying to broaden our perspective. We've been using the phrase from womb to tomb, trying to look at storytelling education as one continuous movement, not just in higher education. So we're wanting some linkages and connections. So global education, lifelong learning of storytelling are our two emphases that we're wanting to work on in the next few years in SHE. Another idea is I would be willing to communicate with any geography teacher, whether elementary, secondary, or a college level. Please communicate with me and be glad to share with you my methods. Talk about how you teach and how we teach.
We are conducting this interview at the National Storytelling Network Conference in July of 2010, where I am receiving an Oracle Award for the service of this work. I just want to note that because you can hear distantly in the background of this interview the kitchen staff busily preparing for another meal in the hotel. I have two offers to mention. The first is I have a 9-part email course called Zen and the Art of Storytelling in 7 Simple Steps, and I recommend you go and sign up for it at theartofstorytellingshow.com/storytelling. And the second offer is I am the founder of the International Storytelling School, which is at thestorytellingschool.com. At the Storytelling School website and also on iTunes, I've started a second podcast called Applied Storytelling. And I invite you to go listen to it. Some of the episodes are available for free. Most of them are available only for members of the school. Larry, do you have any final words of wisdom to the international storytelling community?
Your story is probably filled with universal themes, and personal narratives merged with traditional narratives, merged with the communication of important information about our times, is a thing everybody should and can do.
I think one of the things that comes out of this conversation is that, like geography, storytelling or narrative is built into the human experience. And it's so incredibly a part of what we are. It's like the air we breathe. Just like geography is a part of our landscape, a part of our world. And storytelling is like that. It's such a part of us that I'm always surprised. And people talk to me and they say, oh, you're a storyteller. Oh, it's such a dying breed. There are hardly any storytellers anymore. And I'm like, well, I don't know about that. There's not that many traditional oral narrative cultural keepers anymore. Yes, that's true, but there are many, many, many more storytellers than there ever have been in the past in human existence living at one time. When you start including the artists and the actors and the teachers and the directors and the playwrights and the book writers, and it seems like storytelling is even more successful than it's ever been before. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This guest has written a post for the blog that can be read at www.artofstorytellingshow.com. This post includes a bio and a link to the guest's website, plus other additional information about our discussion. If you want to respond to this show, you can find this post and share your thoughts through the comment system in the blog comment box. If you wish to join a future show as an audience member, go to www.artofstorytellingshow.com/alerts and sign up to the email alert system. You can buy CDs of shows and preloaded iPods on the website. The music was created by Mary Kay Croft, and we are much indebted to her contribution. This show is produced and hosted by me, Brother Wolf, and I am responsible for its content. It is released under a Creative Commons non-derivative and non-commercial license. That means you can copy it and you can give it away, but you can't splice it up or sell it. High-definition versions of this show are considered copyrighted, all rights reserved.